Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and legacy of Henry David Thoreau. An essayist and poet, Thoreau lived a provocative life in which he endeavored to escape the limitations of human society by exploring the wider, wilder, natural world. He was a naturalist, land surveyor, pencil maker, abolitionist, and student of indigenous American culture and artifacts, whose varied experiences informed his writing. His most famous work, 1854's Walden, describes his attempt to live out the transcendentalist philosophy in a cabin in the woods, trying to, quote, live deep and suck out the marrow of life, end quote. Thoreau's writing inspires respect for the wilderness and personal conscience rather than yielding to society's expectations, notably influencing activists Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. For this episode, we are joined by scholar Richard Higgins, author of the recent book Thoreau's God, as well as writer and professor Tom Montgomery Fate, whose work engages with many of the same themes as Thoreau. You can find their full bios in the episode description. This episode is presented in conjunction with our current special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, on display now at the American Writers Museum. Rich and Tom are interviewed by Nate King, Content and Exhibits Manager at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place May 7th, 2026, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Rich and Tom, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I look forward to chatting to you both about Henry David Thoreau and your relation to him and his writing and sort of how he has informed your own professional and personal practices as well. But before we get into that, could you introduce yourselves to our listeners a little bit and tell us a little bit about what you've been up to and your connection to Thoreau? Rich, would you like to get us started?
Sure. I'm Rich Higgins, and I live in Concord, Mass., a fortunate place to be to write about Henry Thoreau. And I'm the author or editor of five books, two of them about Thoreau, and the last one being about Thoreau's spirituality, called Thoreau's God. And my current gig is I'm a research associate at Harvard Divinity School, working on their Transcendentalism project. They have a big Transcendentalism initiative. And I also teach Thoreau in local adult ed programs. And I also have I'm a writer and editor, so I have various writing projects. The most recent thing I've written was a sermon. And that's a really interesting writing discipline because I give talks. And when you give a talk or you speak to a group of people, there's no BS. I mean, you really got to stand up behind your words, and you learn what lands and what doesn't land, if you know what I mean. And that's actually how Thoreau learned to write. I wouldn't say that's how he learned to write, but he began after he left Walden, he encountered a lot of town's neighbors who were saying, "So what were you doing there? What was that all about?" And he gave several talks, and his talks helped him sort of realize what was alive and what wasn't. So that speaking to an audience can really improve you as a writer, I have found. I've done about 30 talks on my book, and I enjoy it, but it's a challenge.
That's fascinating, the parallels between you and Thoreau. And I think you're right. Speaking your words certainly changes them or perhaps makes you think about them in a different way. And I'm fascinated that you picked up on that from Thoreau's career as well. Yeah. Tom, how about yourself? Can you tell us a little bit about your writing and your connection to Thoreau?
Yeah. So I was a English professor for 32 years, recently retired. Now I write. I'm working on a new book of essays. I teach part-time at a little Catholic school nearby, a little private college. I do a lot of workshops, public libraries, memoir workshops, give a fair number of talks, that kind of thing. I was, in terms of my connection with Thoreau, of course, read him in high school, and I was totally bored. The sentences went on forever. What the hell is going on here, et cetera, et cetera. And then I went to college and then grad school in creative writing. And right after that, I went to seminary. So I had this odd connection of a creative writing degree and a religion degree, got interested in writers who were more quote unquote spiritual, people like James Baldwin, Kathleen Norris, Annie Dillard, and Thoreau. And as I began to write, I wondered how they did that. How does someone capture the unknown with language, I guess is how I'd say it. And then later on, to wrap up, maybe 20 years later, we lived in Chicago. We joined a communal farm in Southwest Michigan with a group in Hyde Park, interesting group of people. And I decided to build a cabin. Then I started, you know, being a Thoreau wannabe, even though I lived in the suburbs and had three kids and was working 60 hours a week. So I had fun with a book called Cabin Fever about that paradox. And in the meanwhile, read a lot of Thoreau. And, you know, I'm not a, Rich is a scholar. I'm a reader.
Well, actually, for 25 years, I was a journalist. I didn't mention, I was a reporter.
Oh, yeah, Boston Globe.
Reporter
yeah.
and editor at the Boston Globe. And took a buyout about 20 years ago.
Yeah, I love the, with both of you, the eclectic range of your writing and research and reading. It's great. We've mentioned transcendentalism a little bit, but maybe, Rich, could you sort of give our listeners a brief overview of Thoreau's life and times, you know, when, what was happening around him as he was, you know, growing up, how did he sort of get on his writing journey in a sort of creative pursuit?
Well, Thoreau lived in a time of a turbulent time, not unlike our own. When he was born, when he grew up, Concord was still an agrarian town. Agriculture was the main thing. And the Industrial Revolution came in with its mills and factories and whatnot, and really changed the whole chemistry of the town. Instead of subsistence farming for to supply your own needs, it was market farming and whatnot. And Thoreau really reacted against this, as did his fellow transcendentalists, who were they were actually a reform of Unitarianism, because Unitarianism had become too rational in their view. And so they were romantics, and they believed in the power of intuition, that we have the native innate ability to intuit the moral and spiritual laws of nature, that this is inborn in us. They also believed in the primacy of consciousness to alter oneself and the world. Very important. And Laura Wall says this is, you could define transcendentalism in a sentence, as belief in the divinity of the human soul. And then lastly, this actually translates out into social responsibility, because we're all connected. If you believe in the dignity and worth of every other human being, then you've got to be committed to trying to help them. So that's how transcendentalism got started. And Thoreau was kind of on the periphery of the movement only because he wasn't a real joiner, but his works are eloquent expressions of that movement.
Yeah, thank you for that. And what you just said also makes me think of another characteristic aspect of Thoreau's approach to religion, and the fact that, like you said, not a joiner. Could you talk a little bit about the, you know, I think, and you mentioned it in the book and you go over it, the sort of modern day conception of Thoreau's spiritual life was a naturalist, right? Or a you know, anti-religious, sort of. But I think, but like, as you point out in the book, that's a mischaracterization.
Well, yes, it's partly has to do with current scholarship on Thoreau is very focused on the materiality of his engagement with nature, in an effort to be sort of free of the biases and whatnot that have brought about these baleful things like racism and sexism and all this. They've pared back so much, they're just looking at his almost pre-verbal engagement with the natural world. And I think that that's gone too far, and that it omits the very clear evidence of divine mystery in Thoreau's writing. I mean, he was a harsh critic of organized religion, but he had a palpable sense of the holy himself. He was a very deeply spiritual, and I think he had a religious lens on the world. And the current scholarship also wants to kind of create this duality between matter and spirit, sort of get rid of spirit, we're just going to focus on matter. And Thoreau was not, and he wouldn't have that. They were one and the same for Thoreau. So my book is a bit of a rejoinder to contemporary scholarship that sees him as, you know, having, there's this theory that he became more secular as he got older and was involved more deeply in his natural history studies. He modified his youthful transcendentalism, but he never rejected it.
It also gets me thinking too of like, Tom, you might have to remind me of exactly which piece it was that, or it might have been the review of Rich's book that you did, but you mentioned going to the archives and seeing of the original draft of
Walking.
Yes. Yeah. And you pointed out in that review that of the ways in which you can see him sort of working over, like, do you capitalize the G in God or not? Or, you know, is the capital
or the N in nature? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought it was revealing, you know, to actually see his own handwriting and his own struggle with that at such a base level and such a obvious metaphor for what language can and cannot do. What I was saying before is trying to use language, get at what language can't say. And the thing that interests me, riffing on what Rich just said, is the relationship between religion and spirituality for Thoreau. So I tried to capture that with an analogy that I call a box of wind, and it ties into the etymologies of the word spirit and religion. And my idea was that religion is a box kite, a human-made structure that makes the wind visible to the human beings on the ground. As we hold on to a string, and up in the sky is the box kite. And spirit, of course, is breath or wind. So the wind is the spirit, and then the box kite is the human-made structure. The etymology of religion is religare, to tie together again, a human-made structure. So a religion is supposed to tie together again a community around a story, around a series of rituals, doctrine, et cetera, et cetera. The thing that's important, though, is that the wind can rip that kite up at any moment. The string can break. And I think Thoreau knew that. I think he understood the relationship between those two ideas in a way that a lot of other people at the time didn't, or now. Right? And I think Rich did a beautiful job in that book of capturing, redefining or reimagining what the word religion means, because we've used it too narrowly.
Oh, yes.
From my perspective.
Yeah. No, it was not propositional for Thoreau. It was really a way of living. It was a way of grasping reality. And Tom, I love your metaphor of the box of a bag of wind or box of wind.
I'm a bag of wind.
Yeah. Thoreau had came up with his own, very, very similar, but it was the Aeolian harp. The wind plays, and the music, it translates the wind into music. So it's very, very similar.
I like that.
Yeah. And then I was thinking about was it a bag of wind or a box?
Box kite.
Right. Yeah. So I was thinking while you were saying that the important thing is the wind, you know, moving through it, but people end up fighting about the color and the shape of the box, right? That's the wrong shade. And it's got to be this way. It's got to be that way. Another thing you said about writing and capturing the unknown, Thoreau would totally love that, because he was into, as you saw in my book, the unseen and the unheard, that which is just beyond the range of sight and the range of sound. This very, you know, mystical thing that's just beyond this porous border that we can't quite see. we can't quite name or whatever. So I like that.
Yeah, me too. And that was a part of your book I enjoyed as well, Rich, the ways in which he, you know, he's a writer. We're the Writer's Museum talking about this, but there are some things that are beyond words. And I think also another, the untold is another part of his.
Well, the great paradox there is he was totally into that philosophically, that God is ineffable, but he was a writer.
Yes.
This is the right. And so he needed these images and words to describe this ineffable mystery. So he comes up with all these creative, you know, names for God, you know, the great mower and all these crazy things, because, you know, he's a writer more than he's anything else. And so he had to try, recognizing that his words would fail. He had to try.
Yeah. Right.
So I have a question I wanted to ask Tom, which is that I write in the book that essentially that Thoreau thinks that nature points beyond itself, that nature manifests the divine, but doesn't completely contain it. That there's a way in which I wrote, yeah, that's right. The divine mystery that is imminent, present in nature, but it doesn't, nature and God for Thoreau, most of the time are not completely interchangeable. They have a distinct ontology a little bit. And what do you think about that?
I find that hard to kind of dissect out in terms of the difference between those in his writing. I was struck in the journal, particularly in the later years, how often he refers to God and uses God, that word. And to me, it starts to mean something a little bit different than it does early on. Now, whether that's more as something other than nature, I'm not sure. There's so many contradictions in the things he writes too.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's hard to kind of know where he comes down, and then it evolves so much. I'm always struck. I mean, when you talk about his perception of God, I was really interested in some of the stuff he's written about death, like when Waldo Emerson's son dies, and how he sees that as such a breakdown of the natural process. You know, we all break down and become everything again, et cetera, et cetera. We're all matter. That, and then other times there's I don't know, kind of a different. He gives a different sense of God. I don't have a clear answer to your question.
Absolutely. I often, when I, you know, there are some quotes that really demonstrate the thesis of my book. But if I say them in a talk, I tell people, hey, don't take that to the bank, because this guy's going to say something else different in 2 minutes. And that was because of the dynamism and creativity and evolution of his thought. You know, I mean, yeah. Emerson said, you know, consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. Thoreau was not worried about being consistent. But you do get a drift. You get a sense of where he's going. And I was just saying that I think that pantheism is not wrong, but I think kind of inadequate to describe Thoreau's perception of divine mystery, because it isn't completely coincident with nature. There's something, this business of the distant shore, the other world, this ineffable realm that somehow we can intuit. I mean, so that's what I was getting at there.
Well, it's true. Someone asked me a few weeks ago on a panel, like a similar, not a similar question, but just like what Thoreau believed. And I said that if I call another word that it's not in walking, that he would have trouble capitalizing is belonging. And I get a sense from him that belonging is the reconciliation of one's being and the vast longings that we have. But he also has a sense of this belonging, capital B, the belonging that he's a part of, that we're all a part of, the trees are part of, the bees are part of, et cetera, et cetera. So that word, he doesn't use it very often, but I think about it a lot when I'm reading him, about how the human being belongs and how you reconcile that.
Yeah. And he kind of discovered that at Walden, when he, in the beginning of his time there, he worried that he was going to be lonely, you know, that he was like, is this going to work? Am I going to make it, you know, here for 2 years? And he has this sense of this, the pine needles and the bees and the everything in nature sort of vibrating and communicating to him. And he says, "Oh, wait a minute! I don't lack neighbors. I don't lack friends. I'm a part of this whole symphony right here. It's right in the beginning of Walden." So I think belonging is a good term for his sense of connection with the universe.
And I feel like his writing is inviting readers to figure out how they belong as individuals and in the wider sense. And I like that about his work.
Yeah, I like how you just framed that, because it kind of, to me, I get the sense that he was kind of had an aversion to dogmatic teachings that's the sort of institutionalized religions where you're supposed to just accept that as the one and only truth. But like you said, Rich, the kite can be all different shapes and sizes and still show us the wind, you know. Mm-hmm. And it also goes back to a lot of your book, Rich, is the personal, very personal aspect of religion, or how personal it was to Thoreau. Mm-hmm. You know, like he wrote about it, but it, as he mentioned, is a bit of a struggle for him. So I think I like what you said, Tom, his writing invites readers to also think about their place in the world, not tell them what it is, but give them the space and the tools to think and feel things for themselves. You know, the gospel of this moment or something like that.
Gospel of the present moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
The newer Testament, not the New Testament, but the newer Testament.
I like that. Yeah. It reminded me too of, as I mentioned before, you know, this interview, I grew up in New Hampshire, in the White Mountains, so heavily wooded area.
Whereabouts?
Whereabouts in Woodstock, New Hampshire.
Woodstock,
Loon Mountain. I don't know if you ever went skiing there, but but my dad was a big proponent of the be here now philosophy of Ram Dass, you know. My dad grew up in the 60s, so when I was reading that, I got the, you know, Ram Dass is later than Thoreau, of course, but it's sort of, that's still the gospel of the present moment. And it also, it kind of made me think of the, you know, there's Ram Dass, and then now, as your book also mentions, Rich, it's growing. He's one of the most popular writers out there somehow. And so I'm curious if you could speak to that, the present moment of folks either discovering or rediscovering, that, like in your case, Tom, getting out of high school and not being forced to read it, but coming to it. So I'm curious how you could sort of frame the religious spiritual culture we're in now, and why do you think folks are turning to Thoreau's work in this moment, just sort of for, I don't know, guidance or inspiration? What do you think, Rich?
Well, he is really the paradigmatic spiritual seeker. And that's what people are interested in today. And just for the very same reason that you said, that the spirit is always moving. And so efforts to put it into a kind of a theological shoebox are not going to work, and are not working for a lot of people. So Thoreau was very opposed to dogma, very opposed to a fixed revelation in the past. It's happening right now. I mean, Emerson said that we need to have religion by revelation to us as individuals. And with the decline of religious institutions and even organized religion, I think Thoreau's seeker spirituality is just, you know, more attractive to people than it ever has been before.
I don't know how to frame this, but I'm curious what you think, Rich, about, I've spent a fair amount of time on the Pine Ridge Reservation with this medicine man, and I've written about it and everything. And he often talks about the difference between a seer and a seeker. And I sometimes think that Thoreau might have, and that some people are both, mm-hmm. you know, in other words, they are, you know, the pilgrim, they're seeking, but they also have moments of revelation, unlike some other people, and are able to share them. And maybe that's what holy people are. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's always the seer versus the seeker. That always interests me.
I like that distinction. I like that distinction. Seeking can have two connotations. You can be trying so hard to grasp the truth that you can't be grasped by it. because you're so, trying so hard to grasp it. So, and I don't think Thoreau, just seeking in the case when I say it, and if Thoreau was a spiritual seeker, I mean, he was open to and looking past the conventional forms of religion to something beyond. And it was a sense of openness to truth wherever he found it. And I think of it more as being open-minded than grasping after something.
Yeah, and the seeker-seer, it reminds me of a piece you wrote, Tom, that I recently read that you shared with me, one of those pieces where you talk about fishing. It's not called catching. You don't go trout catching, you go trout fishing. And, you know, and I think for Thoreau, it's sort of the destination is not as important as the journey, as, you know, finding is not as important as seeking, perhaps. Like,
yeah. And that's, again, riffing on what Rich just said in Walking, when he talks about, he makes up these two etymologies for the word saunter, which is the verb he uses to describe walking, which is kind of one of his central, it seems like one of his central kind of spiritual practices. He does it every day for a long time and takes notes and everything. But so the first etymology is a sentitere, which means to the Holy Land, or sentitere, a holy lander, like a pilgrim at Canterbury or to the Hajj or something like that. And then the other one is sans, the other etymology he gives is sans terre, or without land or without a home. And so you've got this image of the pilgrim who doesn't belong anywhere but belongs everywhere, who, you know, constantly arrives, but there's no destination. And that's what he's kind of advocating in that essay, is that's how to live, you know. And that's always been an important piece for me. And when I learned that he made those etymologies up in my 30s, that was another revelation. It's like, oh, it's fiction. But I was sure those were actual etymologies for 20 years. But anyway, to me, that points at his religion and his spirituality.
Yeah, totally. And I also had a similar reaction when I found out he made those up. But it also, it kind of reminds me of the example you use, Rich, about the Cenobites, and the sort of playfulness, the pun that he used in that passage. So then you're like, but, you know, yeah. I don't know. I thought that was, there's something about it that I found, I don't know, reassuring, that he can also be funny. I don't know, you know.
Oh, absolutely. we can, when we talk about his writing, we can get into it. But I think he was wickedly funny. There was a real dry humor, but definitely he had fun writing and could be very funny. And but maybe, just to wrap up this, what we're talking about, I think that Thoreau was, among other people like Emerson and Schleiermacher, trying to divorce the religious sentiment, the religious impulse, which is kind of universal in people, from its institutional context, which, of course, is a full-blown thing today. But in the 1830s and 40s, it was pretty novel.
Yeah, and that was also a time period where there was other, you know, like you mentioned, Unitarian, that he actually got even further distance from, but there was already some sort of a lot of other movements that were kind of
on the right and the left. You had the conservatives leaving the Unitarian churches to form the Trinitarian churches because they thought the Unitarians were too liberal. And even farther conservative, you had the Second Great Awakening happening and the evangelical slain in Christ kind of stuff. And then you had the religious liberalism, kind of the humanist movement also taking shape at that time, the theosophy and Eastern religion. And so it was a real smorgasbord going on.
Fascinating time. And it kind of, like you also mentioned, it's similar to this time, I see a little bit. And that's part of our special exhibit that's on display right now, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, looks at a lot of very broadly, and but, you know, like someone like Flannery O'Connor is included, who's very Catholic and writes about Catholicism. Yep. But other writers like Thoreau are more, they're not necessarily giving up religion, but they are giving up the things that they inherited that were given to them, you know, and searching for things on their own. You mentioned Tom Baldwin, you know, James Baldwin is included, other writers like Ursula K. Le Guin, you know, folks like that who were exploring their own personal spirituality and then sharing that through their writing in various ways. So I just,
It's an excellent exhibit. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. But it just opened in November of this past year, and it will be up for at least the year.
Good.
Yeah, but definitely recommend come checking it out. And Thoreau is included. There's one aspect of the exhibit, which is a small square room, and we have put projected onto three sides of that room video, like a 7.5 minute video loop of different scenes from across the country, mostly natural scenes. And we, of course, had to include Thoreau in that, and a quote of his about, I meant to write it down, but I left my notebook at my apartment. But the quote about him finding a bit of God in each snowflake, you know, so it's a wintry tundra scene. And it's a powerful part of the exhibit. And his words, the nature aspect, especially folks have been enjoying. But I wanted to maybe talk a little bit, because we've mentioned Emerson and some of the other transcendentalists. That time period of American letters has always been fascinating to me. And so I wonder, Rich, if you could talk about how all those writers sort of influenced each other and exchanged ideas, and, you know, were there any rifts or anything like that?
Rifts among writers, that's unimaginable.
I know, right?
Well, I think Thoreau was probably most influenced by Emerson when he read Nature, came out in 1836, and it portrayed the natural world as an organic language of spirit. And this really had a huge effect on Thoreau. And you see that kind of idealism throughout his writing. Thoreau was also drew on Wordsworth, was very important. He had a kind of an elegiac sense of the loss of childhood wonder and innocence that Wordsworth wrote about. Goethe was another big influence. Goethe sort of, I don't see, he, you know, pioneered the descriptive excursion essay that Thoreau picked up on. And he also really emphasized the importance of the vegetative principle as this organic growth of things that Thoreau picked up. He was very influenced by, he loved the Greeks, Plato and Homer. I mean, they're throughout his writing. You had asked about how we would see this kind of evidence. And I looked in Walden. There's a great, again, funny reference to Homer. He's in his cabin, his house. He never called it a hut, by the way. He rarely called it a cabin. He was very proud. It was a very well-built little house, and he called it a house. But he's in there, and it's summertime, and he writes, "Morning brings back the heroic ages. I was as much affected by the faint hum of a mosquito making its invisible and unimaginable tour through my apartment at earliest dawn, when I was sitting with doors and windows open, as I could be by any trumpet that ever sang of fame. It was Homer's Requiem, itself an Iliad and Odyssey in the air, singing its own wrath and wanderings." But Thoreau he was not involved in the Transcendentalist Club as much as the others. They were mainly Unitarian ministers who were in the Transcendental Club. And Thoreau did his writing on his own and was not really trying to cross-reference or debate, or he was not looking over his shoulder what he wrote. He was interested in being original.
Yeah, I see that in his writing for sure. And now, what about on the other end? Writers who you can tell have been influenced by Thoreau. I of course, you two, that's for sure. But you know, are there any? And actually, you know, as I ask that question, I realize that might be a rather long list to kind of narrow down, especially in American letters. But so maybe are there any that either contemporary or still, you know, writers of the past as well that you've enjoyed writing and you see parallels with Thoreau's either life and or writing?
Well, Tom mentioned Annie Dillard, and who else, Tom, did you mention?
Baldwin, I think.
Baldwin, yeah. I don't
know about Baldwin.
I don't know if he was influenced by
Kathleen Norris. I mentioned Kathleen Norris.
Yeah, right. Well, I think today, Rob McFarland, you guys know about Robert McFarland?
Yeah.
Nature writer, an English nature writer who's just spectacular and very prolific and very much in Thoreau's way of thinking. Robin Wall Kimmerer, Wendell Berry, of course, is a poet.
Yeah.
Mary Oliver is a poet. Bill McKibben. Do you know Christian Wyman? He's a poet.
Oh, yeah.
He's great. And
another person I think of is David Gessner, who's done maybe 15 books. He's done a couple on Thoreau. His last book was called, I think it's called Quiet Desperation, Savage Delight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about Thoreau's relevance in the midst of COVID,
mm-hmm.
you know, as the really interesting book. But he's a really good environmental writer who I've read probably 10 of his books and really admired his work. Recent, you know, a living writer.
Yeah.
There are a lot. There are a lot of people.
Right. Yeah, there are, yes.
A lot of environmental writers. Yeah, I can think of others too. Todd Davis, who's a really amazing poet at, I don't know if he's retired yet. He's done maybe a dozen books of poetry. A lot of them have that same sentiment as Thoreau.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to promote my friends.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah. and since you mentioned COVID, Tom, this is a good, I think, segue into one of my questions I wanted to ask, which was, you know, I wonder what about his work remains relevant, and also, you know, how can it inform our current moment? I think there's a lot of, again, another rather open-ended question.
I mean, I'm just reminded that what Thoreau reminds me to do, and maybe other environmental writers, is that when we write, we teach ourselves and our readers how to pay attention to the world. It's a very basic thing, but we forget that.
Very important.
So Thoreau teaches us that over and over again. All these years later, same journals, the same books, they're still teaching us that. The other thing I've learned from Thoreau, and I think those writers we mentioned do, is that Thoreau is always looking out at the world and in at the self simultaneously. So he's got the two eyes going out, and what he sees with those eyes creates the eye that we hear in his language, right? So there's a balance of looking out and looking in. Now, those are two big ideas, but those are things that I think he still continues to teach, as do other important writers. Rich, what were you going to say?
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I've often used, I may be in one of the books, but the idea of his having dual vision, with seeing a natural object as a fact with one eye and as a parable with the other, you know. I think that Thoreau's relevance, that especially in our increasingly AI-driven society, he's the individual's individual, and an icon of integrity, of an increasingly rare quality. What's odd about Thoreau for me is that he lived at a time when to go 30 miles an hour on a train was a revolutionary thing. And, you know, the closest to kind of digital communication we have today was when they laid the transatlantic cable. And after, you know, fumbling around, they found out the queen had a cold. I mean, so he lived in so long ago, but he nevertheless addresses our modern moral and environmental issues. I mean, it's astonishing. I made a short list because I thought you might ask me about this, and there were five ways that I think Thoreau speaks to us today. And the first is on the environment, his call to live more simply, to use nature's resources more wisely, to preserve wildness. These are all things that Thoreau called for. He saw the consequences of our ravaging nature even in his day. And, you know, he didn't invent the term, but he basically sketched out the idea of ecology. And then Thoreau provided the moral underpinnings of contemporary political activism and the individual's right to resist immoral laws. his, we've talked about it, his reverence for the divine in nature and non-institutional spirituality. It really expanded the category of religion in his day and was a antecedent of today's spiritual left. Oh yeah, his critique of materialism. I mean, he was, you know, in the economy chapter of Walden, he's, you know, unforgiving. He blasted corporate greed. He said that, quote, mills produce clothing, not that mankind may be well and honestly clad, but unquestionably that the corporations may be enriched. And then finally, the importance, what Tom just said, I mean, the importance that he placed on wakefulness and attention is so relevant in our culture of distraction and the constant intrusion of screens. Real sustained attention was like a prayer for Thoreau. Mm-hmm. And in all those ways, he speaks to us.
Yeah. In a culture of perpetual distraction, he reminds us that we are now reactors. We all we do is react. We cannot reflect. We're trying to remember, how do we reflect? That balance of reflection and reaction is something that's super important right now, even in terms of how our brains are evolving.
Yeah.
So I think he models a different way. And another image I have of him is in the fourth floor garret in his, you know, in his late 30s. And he could look a few hundred yards in one direction and see the Concord River and the little rowboat he built, where he would go and drift on the river and, you know, take notes and pick different plants and figure out what they were and everything. Mm-hmm. The art. And he could also look a few hundred yards in the other direction at the Fitchburg railway station, where he would put escaped slaves on the train at night. And that balance of art and activism is something, a model that I really admire, and I don't think people talk enough about with him, was he was able to do both of those things. Mm-hmm. Was a Renaissance person in that way. And it's something I've always admired about him. Both very different ways of being in the world, in a way, you know, but he embodied both.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think sometimes, you know, the characterization or mental image of him is someone who kind of just left society, right? And, you know, we just went out into the woods and only, you know, only for his own research. But he didn't, like you said, he was very much engaged with what was happening around him. And yeah, I think for him that art and activism were, you know, much like his approach to nature and God were in, you know, one in the same, right? Like, yeah.
I don't know if it was Rich. It might have been Rich who said this, but it was, he didn't go to escape Concord or escape the world, but he went there to critique it. Yeah. And I think that's makes more sense.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I don't know if you have the recent meme where it's like touch grass, you know, like get off your screens and go touch grass. It's like he was the originator of that, you know.
Better than smoke grass, I suppose.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's another option.
Yeah. That's a different podcast. And I kind of wanted to, we're getting close to the end, and I really love, I didn't mean that, but I enjoyed how you ended your book, Rich, on the chapter on love. So I wanted to sort of, because, you know, I think, like you mentioned in the book, you know, we could use a little bit more of this. And it's just his very short one sentence quote, "Our religion is where our love is."
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious why you chose to end your book, Thoreau's God, with that chapter on love and Thoreau's understanding of love.
Yeah. Well, I think that Thoreau has a kind of a reputation as a scornful Hebrew prophet or something like that. And he was he had a great joy and a great love of nature. And it was his love of the world and his love of his life that led him to live it so deliberately. Thoreau writes in one of his poems about the great love, the love untold. And he means the sense that we know it's it's a love that isn't always spoken directly to us by another person, but it's somehow out there in the world that Thoreau knew he was loved by the universe. Maybe loved by God, I don't know, but loved that was beyond just the category of a single relationship, this kind of a larger cosmic love. And so I thought that was why I wanted to end with that, because I thought it was so beautiful. And it's a side of Thoreau that's not often lifted up. But love was very important to him.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the breadth of that love. And, you know, it's not, like you said, not just, two partners in a relationship, but the love he was feeling and groping for, as you also say, it's much bigger. And is that the unspeakable sort of
the love untold, you know, like it's there for all of us. Well, before we end, you had asked about whether there were particular passages in Thoreau that we wanted to lift up or aspects of him I didn't get to mention, but he was a very funny guy. He made gloves for Lydia Emerson's chickens because they were scratching up her roses, her rose plants, and she complained about that. So he designed gloves for that, and he also made dollhouses for Emerson's kids, and had great melon parties. He was he won an award for the largest squash from the Boston Herald, of all things, 123 pounds. But the thing is, so I have a passage about, because we're interested in Thoreau as a writer, and Tom, this is, I don't know what your selection, but this to me is just so emblematic of Thoreau's writing. He's writing about snow crystals in 1856. So it's December, and he writes, "The thin snow now driving from the north lodges on my coat, beautiful star crystals, thin and partly transparent. They are about an inch in diameter, perfect little wheels with six spokes, or rather six perfect little leaflets, fern-like, with a distinct straight and slender midrib raying out from the center. How full of creative genius is the air in which they are generated. I should hardly admire more if real stars fell and lodged on my coat. Nature is full of genius, full of the divinity, so that not a snowflake escapes its fashioning hand. I am nearer to the source of the snow, its primal, auroral and golden hour of infancy." And then he writes, that I love this, "On the Saskatchewan in Canada, where there's no man of science to behold, still down they come, and not the less fulfill their destiny. What a world we live in, where myriads of these little disks, so beautiful to the most prying eye, are whirled down on every traveler's coat, and on the restless squirrel's fur, and on the far-stretching fields and forests and wooded dells and mountaintops. Far away from the haunts of man, they roll down some little slope, melt and lose their beauty in the mass, ready anon to swell some little stream, and so at last return to the universal ocean from which they came. There they lie, like the wreck of chariot wheels after a battle in the skies. These glorious spangles, the sweepings of heaven's floor. And as they melt, they sing the mysteries of the number six, 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 six."
Thank you for that.
How many sentences was that? One?
Yeah.
Three.
Yeah.
I'm glad you shared that passage, because the immersive room I was talking about that's in the exhibit, that is the passage, that's the quote we used that I couldn't remember. So thanks
really?
For covering.
How about
that?
Wow.
Yeah. Tom, did you have any quotes or passages?
Well,
it
just reminded me, when I taught him, I used to say that we talk about sentence structure, and sentences can feel like popcorn, or they can feel like slow moving rivers. And his felt like long, slow moving rivers. And you had to learn to pause on the semicolons and the commas, like there were little rocks in the stream where you had to take stock and then keep going. I was trying to use one of his metaphors. I have a piece that's not writing based. It's more about the idea that struck me. And this is what he wrote when when Emerson's son Waldo died. I just love the idea. As for Waldo, he died as the mist rises from the brook, which the sun will soon dart his rays through. Do not the flowers die every autumn? He had not even taken root here. I was not startled to hear that he was dead. It seemed the most natural event that could happen. His fine organization demanded it, and nature gently yielded its request. It would have been strange if he had lived. I just like the idea of that, and the idea of him writing that in his journal and then sharing it with Emerson and imagining the conversation they might have had.
That's lovely.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That is, and I was trying to find it, but I might not be able to track it down. But do either of you happen to know, because you mentioned that passage of death, Thoreau's final words? There's, I think, six of them, one of which was moose, I believe. If I
Indian.
Moose.
Now comes good sailing.
Yeah. Is that, yeah. What are the, can you say them again?
Now comes good sailing. Moose, Indian, now comes good sailing. I think now comes good sailing, and then moose and Indian.
Sophia, his sister Sophia, was reading to him from A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, and she was reading the passage when, right at the end of the trip, they get this incredible wind, and they go 50 miles down the last day, just ripping through the water. And so as she's reading that, as she's about to read that, Thoreau says, "And now comes good sailing." And she says those are his last words. Other people have different last words.
Well,
but his last words are not last words. There are about 5 million of them that we're still reading and enjoying.
That's right, yeah.
But it was fascinating. He was dying for a long time because he had tuberculosis. So a lot of people came and visited him. Just his attitude, I don't know about you, Rich, but I know a lot of people that are, as I get older, that are passing on, and I'm going to funerals and talking, talking with people about death a lot.
Yeah.
And I find what he wrote and the things he said during the last week or two of his life
incredible.
To be very beautiful and uplifting.
He died with more equanimity than almost any person I can imagine. And, his most famous quote, I think, of all his, in Walden, "I went to the woods to live deliberately and not, drive life into a corner, be spare and not come to the end and find out that I had not lived." Well, he had put his life where his words were there, and really he was comfortable that he had lived fully, and died without remorse, without anger at God or something for his he didn't complain. It's really extraordinary, really. And then just one thing I always have to say, because I'm always not defending Thoreau, but in terms of his personality and what kind of person he was. Well, I think whether or not kids like someone is a very good measure of their character. And when Thoreau died for his funeral, the school superintendent was Bronson Alcott, and he canceled school for the day.
Canceled school, yeah.
And 300 school children with wildflowers followed Thoreau's coffin to the grave. And, kids loved Thoreau, and there must have been a reason.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for that. I'm glad you mentioned his personality right there, Rich, because we Writers Museum and this podcast, we look at often, we're looking at the writing, but the human behind the writing is also important to understand, I think, to better understand their work as well.
Well, the last thing I wanted to say was a question you had asked was what role spirituality played in Thoreau's creative pursuits. Mm. And I really like that question because spirituality and creativity are so close to each other. Spirituality was like a valve that opened up Thoreau's creative genius. His life shows the absolute connection between art and religion. Both involve disciplined observation, contemplation, and creative expression in a way that one becomes a channel for something larger than oneself. That's true for the artist. It's true for the person who's worshiping whatever they consider divine.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And thank you for joining me on this podcast, Tom. Thank
Great.
You as well. I had a blast.
Honored. I greatly enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
I did too. Thank you very much, both of you. Great fun.
And listeners, if you would like to hear more from Tom, he will be at a panel discussion at our American Writers Festival this coming June 7th at the Harold Washington Library Center. There's a link in the episode description for you to check it out. He'll be on a panel about the spiritual essence of storytelling with a couple of other Chicagoland writers. So definitely come check it out. It's a free event, free program. So all-day festival should be fun. Tom will be there.
I've got to get myself to the American Writers Museum and see it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I would love to show you around American Prophets, especially. But the museum as a whole, but our special exhibit is right up your alley for
It's an
sure.
amazing place.
Great.
Yeah, it's really
Wonderful.
unusual. Yeah.
All
Thanks
right.
again, Nate.
Thank you,
Yeah.
Nate. Thank you, Tom.
And thank you, Rich. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Nation of Writers, part of the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.